friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 116 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and a general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
We also have the pimping bell, which makes a nice dinging noise whenever especially noteworthy content arises. So pay attention when the pimping bell sings. And our mission is to come at your ears every 2 weeks with discussions of some of the latest research in the world of clinical dermatology. And Michelle has got our first article today.
So we're going to discuss a unique treatment for alopecia areata combining epinephrine with intralesional steroids. This is an article out of Cutis, and the chief authors are Eugenio Stratulat and Peter Moose. Looks like, I think that's how you say that. And this is out of Massachusetts and Los Angeles. So this is a very interesting article about how to tweak a treatment that we all do in our offices to potentially help it work better. The practice points are that alopecia areata can be refractory to first-line treatment and may benefit from intralesional triamcinolone diluted up to 2.5 milligrams per milliliter with 1% lidocaine and epinephrine in place of normal saline. The local vasoconstrictive properties of the epinephrine may potentiate the intralesional triamcinolone and also may potentially play an independent role in treating this condition. So as we all know, alopecia areata is an autoimmune condition where we have a non-scarring alopecia that can be extensive and can be refractory to treatment. One of the mainstays of treatment in our clinics is to dilute intralesional triamcinolone to about 2.5 milligrams per milliliter with saline and inject it into the frontal scalp or sometimes to 5 milligrams per milliliter in the scalp. Sometimes people will even go to 10. You do have to be careful for scalp atrophy under those circumstances. They're presenting here two cases of severe alopecia areata in their practice that responded well to intralesional triamcinolone diluted instead of saline with lidocaine with epinephrine. And notably, both of these cases had been recalcitrant to pure intralesional triamcinolone previously. The epinephrine's ability to cause vasoconstriction may help maintain the triamcinolone in the environment that you're trying to treat, similarly to how we use it for lidocaine anesthesia to maintain the lidocaine in the environment where we inject it due to its vasoconstrictive properties. Of course, other treatments for alopecia areata include potent topical steroids. We talked about intralesional triamcinolone. Patients can also be treated with immune modulating or immune suppressive drugs. Recently, there have been Janus kinase inhibitors such as baricitinib approved for alopecia areata. But of course, systemic treatments do have risk and they're not appropriate for all patients. Contact immunotherapy is also something that can be utilized. This is unlicensed and off-label use of a non-pharmaceutical grade agent, so you do have to be thoughtful about this because it can entail some risk to do this treatment. But what you're doing under those circumstances is you're trying to elicit a second type of immune response. In this case, an allergic contact dermatitis. I kind of think of it as the look over here to the white blood cells to get them distracted so they quit doing what they're doing. Here they present these two cases of extensive alopecia areata that they treated with this treatment protocol. Their first patient was an 11-year-old patient. She'd been recalcitrant to multiple intralesional triamcinolone injections without any kind of improvement and subsequently was treated with the intralesional triamcinolone buffered with 1% lidocaine and epinephrine in a 1 to 100,000 dilution, which is standard for what's used in clinic. They were able to notice some improvement at 3 months with near complete regrowth at 7 months and 5 months, respectively, for the eyebrows and for the occipital scalp. Notably, this was ophiasis pattern alopecia areata, which can be significantly recalcitrant to treatment. The patient, as patients do with alopecia areata, developed new locations of alopecia areata in the scalp, which also then responded to the same treatment. And she had improvement of the eyebrows without recurrence at 5 months. There wasn't any localized skin atrophy or other adverse effects. Their second patient was a 34-year-old woman who had previously untreated alopecia areata for 2 months' duration. And she had this involving, again, the right occipital scalp. They made the decision to treat the patient with a similar treatment protocol with the buffered lidocaine in the 1 to 100,000 dilution of epinephrine with the 2.5 milligrams per milliliter of triamcinolone and noticed appreciable hair growth at 1 month with substantial improvement at 3 months. So the reason why this might work, when we think about the hair follicle, it is kind of a dynamic mini organ. It has its own immune and hormonal microenvironment, and it should be privileged from the immune system, which should protect it from immune destruction, which is what occurs in alopecia areata. So often we discuss the loss of immune privilege that can be a predecessor of alopecia areata. You get that breakdown in immune privilege, and that allows for auto-inflammatory T cells, usually CD8 positive T lymphocytes, to cause infiltration and apoptosis of the hair follicle keratinocytes, which inhibits hair shaft production.
Seems like the bell should be ringing in here somewhere.
That's a very good point. I do tend to forget to ring the bell for myself, but I shall ring that bell.
Copy of the pimping bell, maybe.
I'm going to have to send you one. That'd be fun. So we talked about how the therapies can work for patients who have alopecia areata. As first line, we use intralesional and topical corticosteroids for patients that have less than 50% scalp involvement. And usually we use triamcinolone because it has easy availability and isn't as atrophogenic as other injectable steroids. Of course, you can bypass the epidermis when it's injected, so you're getting closer to the hair follicle to achieve maximal efficacy. Controlled studies for intralesional triamcinolone in alopecia areata are sparse. There aren't very many of them in our literature. The authors of this paper cited a meta-analysis that looked at 5 and 10 milligram per milliliter intralesional triamcinolone diluted in normal saline, which showed equal efficacy, which is one of the practice-changing articles that I think a lot of people went to a lower concentration of the triamcinolone to help to avoid some of the atrophy that can occur at higher concentrations. But you do sometimes have less significant regrowth with lower strength of intralesional triamcinolone. Other diluents than normal saline haven't really been extensively studied, so this is kind of a proof of concept case report here. So they also bring forward a few other patients from their clinic that they go into a little bit less detail about, but that also received similar treatment and had been previously recalcitrant to therapy. What's very interesting is thinking about the role of the epinephrine here. So the role of epinephrine is partially to decrease the rate of clearance of the triamcinolone from the hair follicle's microenvironment, which might provide a better therapeutic effect. Laser Doppler blood flow meters have actually been able to demonstrate that epinephrine at 1 to 100,000 dilution injected in the scalp can cause vasoconstriction, decreases the blood flow rate and clearance of other substances in the same solution. A more gradual systemic absorption is also achieved, so you might have less of a peak of absorption of the steroid, which might cause also less problems such as osteoporosis or immune suppression. The epinephrine itself may be beneficial as well. There have been animal studies that have shown that the sympathetic nervous system is important in hair follicle growth. And in a mouse model, they had chemical sympathectomy that led to diminished norepinephrine levels in the skin, and that was accompanied by a decrease in keratinocyte proliferation and hair growth. They found conversely that norepinephrine could promote hair follicle growth in an organotypic skin culture model. So potentially there might be some role for the epinephrine. In another study, topically applied isopropanol, which is a pan-androgenic receptor agonist, accelerated hair follicle growth in organotypic skin culture. And external light, temperature, and changes that can maybe stimulate hair growth may actually operate partially through the sympathetic nervous system as well to help promote anagen hair follicle growth. And this has been shown in some cultured skin explants. So there's possibility that the epinephrine may serve two roles in this setting. So in these authors' experience, this has been helpful. It has improved outcomes above just straight injected intralesional triamcinolone, and it's done in the same fashion that all of us are used to injecting triamcinolone into the scalp. So it's not a new technique to learn, just a new way to deliver the medication. So this is a safe, relatively inexpensive modification. It might decrease systemic absorption peaks, as well as improve efficacy in the local hair follicle environment where we're seeking treatment. So I'm going to try this. I think that this is a reasonable thing to do. The anesthesia may also, after the first couple of pokes, provide improved comfort for the patient. So I think that this is a reasonable opportunity to investigate. And the authors, of course, have urged further study, as any responsible author should.
Yeah, I like it. It's easy. I like things that are easy. So instead of asking my MAs to drop ILK and normal saline, I'll just say, use the lighter with epi instead. And then maybe patients will get a better result.
I'll say that I have accidentally done this in a pediatric patient because she was really kind of trepidatious about this. So I did this and she regrew like gangbusters. And I was like, she was just a kid and she got better, but maybe it was the epinephrine. I was impressed with how much regrowth she got in just one treatment. So I'm kind of, I feel like it probably does work from my own accidental N of one. So we'll see. We'll try it more extensively.
All right. We'll do it. I learned about that article actually at the Intermountain Dermatology Society meeting, which I recently attended. Good to see everybody there, including a few of our listeners. And there was also the Practical Dermatology for Primary Care meeting at the same time, which I was in charge of. And I was happy to also be able to attend the IDS meeting, Intermountain Dermatology Society, where I learned some stuff. And I was hoping to pass along some of that stuff to you listeners. So here are some pearls. Garrett Komen, one of our graduated residents, hi Garrett, talked about AI in dermatology, including the use of ChatGPT. And one of the audience members said that he had been using ChatGPT to help write prior authorization letters. I thought that sounded genius. I tried it myself once, but it actually wasn't all that helpful. It just still had a bunch of fill in the blanks, but you could probably get it sorted out. So that it
have to be careful. Sometimes the ChatGPT can confabulate resources if it's citing articles, and it'll be by authors that make sense because it's doing the same thing that it does for everything else. So it's like mining data that's available and putting together things that kind of seem to make sense. So just make sure if it puts resources in that they're real resources.
Yes, Garrett also talked about his experience with that as well. Just make stuff up. In terms of hair loss, Dr. Paul Pering talked to us about some hair loss stuff. So for minoxidil, we're big fans of minoxidil on the podcast. I usually use 5 milligrams per day for men and 2.5 milligrams for women, but he doesn't do it based on gender. He does it based on their weight. So if they're 60 kilograms or over, he uses 5 milligrams. If they're under 60 kilograms, he uses a max of 2.5.
Fun.
And I usually divide it BID, but Dr. Pering recommends just do it all at once in the evening. And he says after maintenance is reached, it's okay to decrease to thrice weekly dosing rather than every day.
Okay.
Maybe I'll change that in my own personal prescription. If the patient has certain diseases that can put them at risk for pericarditis or pericardial effusion, you probably want to discuss with their other providers if you're thinking about minoxidil. So connective tissue disease, for example, because of their increased risk of pericarditis, and then chronic kidney disease or congestive heart failure for pericardial effusion.
I also do this, especially if they have pre-existing cardiac disease. That's very smart to do.
I usually forget to do it. But in my defense, most of my patients are young and otherwise healthy and probably don't have that stuff. And patients with history of malignancies like breast and uterine cancer, spironolactone is probably okay. We actually discussed that in episode 8. But he said he would be hesitant to do finasteride or dutasteride in people with history of those malignancies. And he does do some lab work for hair loss patients, which honestly I don't do, but maybe I'll start now that Dr. Pering has recommended it. He does thyroid studies. He checks ferritin. I know you've talked about ferritin before, Michelle. He says we should target 40 to 70. And if it's low, recommends that the patient take 65 milligrams of elemental iron 3 times a week with orange juice. Apparently that helps absorb the iron. And then recheck it in 3 months.
I have also picked up a couple patients for hair loss that actually had hemochromatosis that wasn't diagnosed. So if the ferritin comes back really high and they don't have an explanation for why they would have a high ferritin, you may have picked up accidental hemochromatosis because that can also present with hair loss.
And for me, you would find hemanchromatosis because of my muscular physique. He also checks their vitamin D levels, specifically 25-hydroxy vitamin D, not the dihydroxy, but apparently this was the good one. He targets 40 to 100 and supplements with 4,000 IUs of D2 or D3 daily for 12 weeks and then reassesses. Alopecia areata, ILK at 2.5 seems to be just as effective as higher doses, kind of like what we just talked about. Moving on to other stuff. So HUVS, hypocomplementemic urticarial vasculitis syndrome. I actually just acquired a patient who has this condition, but apparently COPD occurs in 50% of these patients, and it is progressive and the most frequent cause of death. These people should definitely avoid smoking. Also, 72% of patients with HUVS have angioedema.
I like the ha you put in there.
That's my Jewish ancestry. And hydroxychloroquine can be helpful in this condition. Let's talk hidradenitis suppurativa. We've talked about it a lot in the podcast. Here is some more about it. HS patients who become pregnant should perhaps be followed by MFM because they do have higher rates of complications. In men, you can consider finasteride. Obviously not spironolactone, but finasteride could be an option. A lot of the HS experts seem to have different approaches for their ILK in HS. This particular speaker likes ILK-10. He injects with a 1 1/4 inch, 27 gauge needle. This sort of allows him to stick them once and then sort of poke all around to avoid multiple needle pokes. If you want to calm somebody's flare down, you might consider prednisone, 20 to 30 milligrams daily for 2 to 3 weeks. By the way, see episode 5 for some guidelines. Doxycycline seems just as effective as the rifampin plus clindamycin plan. I know a lot of people, including myself, kind of jumped on the rifampin plus clindamycin just because it seemed new and cool. Maybe it's not any better than the old doxy. Laser hair removal can be good for these patients. Yep. And don't skip the inflamed lesions during treatment. In fact, double pulse the inflamed lesion and treat even the non-hair-bearing areas in the spots there. I recently had a patient get insurance approval to get laser hair removal for her HS.
Wow.
But the insurance required that I perform the procedure. So I have now been trained on how to do laser hair removal and hopefully can help out some of our HS patients.
And then if you want to learn more about HS, we have the All HS Best of HS Volume 1, Episode 71, right?
That's right. And one thing you might hear in there is Resorcinol ointment might be helpful for it. Sometimes it's expensive to get at compounding pharmacies, but this speaker has found a good price from a pharmacy in Wisconsin called Smith Pharmacy. Resorcinol 15% ointment. Let's talk about something way less common. Pityriasis rubra pilaris.
Woohoo!
Shout out to Terry Greiling, who talked about this one. So IL-17 and IL-23 biologics should be first line, according to Dr. Greiling. Guselkumab and secukinumab are possibly the best. Also, there's a study based on transcriptomics that suggests that PRP could be considered a subtype of psoriasis. Consider that when writing appeal letters. This patient has PRP type psoriasis. Let's talk about leg ulcers and pyoderma gangrenosum. Shout out to Alex Ortega, who talked about this. So if people have trouble putting on their compression stockings, there is a device that you can buy online called the Stocking Butler that can help you put them on. For venous ulcers, doxycycline, 150 milligrams daily, can potentially help. Is there anything doxy doesn't do? If you're biopsying...
We talked about festoons that one time, which was pretty cool.
That's right. You can even inject it into people. If you're going to biopsy near the ulcer, because you think maybe this is PG or something else, take the sample from the perilesional area. So not the ulcer itself, not the edge, but within 1 centimeter of the edge. However, if you think this could be an infection or a neoplasm, you want to also take a sample from the wound edge itself. If you have a patient with pyoderma gangrenosum or hidradenitis suppurativa who's going to go into surgery for some reason, continue their biologic medications. If they're on prednisone, try to decrease the prednisone dose to less than 20 milligrams a day. One thing that can cause leg ulcers is livedoid vasculopathy. I recently acquired a patient with this as well. These are unusual things in my primarily pediatric practice. But consider clobetasol ointment plus methotrexate, about 15 milligrams a week, possibly even JAK inhibitors. Some patients with livedoid vasculopathy apparently have a significant inflammatory component, and that's why some of these anti-inflammatory drugs can be helpful, especially if there's no history of clotting or a hypercoagulable state. Something like methotrexate apparently can be especially considered then. We had a great talk from our dentist, who's an adjunct in our department, Dr. Brian Trump, no relation, about oral pathology. So here are some things that he says. If you think you see oral lichen planus, biopsy it. In the mouth, you can use clobetasol gel. He says don't use ointments or creams in the mouth. Dry the area you're going to treat first, like with a hairdryer on cold, and then apply the medication. He also likes Mycolog 2, which is nystatin / triamcinolone for Perlesh. He says use it QID, 15 grams with one refill. Treat for a week, even if it resolves before then. He says, anytime you're treating fungal, treat for 7 to 10 days. Dexamethasone swish and spit. If you're prescribing that for somebody, don't actually swish it, because that just makes it all frothy and not work so well. Just hold it in the mouth and roll it around. And we can also roll on back to another article. A lot of good stuff from IDS. Thanks to all the speakers.
Well, Luke, I have a question for you.
Shoot.
Do you ever have patients who have rosacea that you just can't seem to get better?
Why, yes. And I really wish I didn't have to just treat them with doxycycline all the time.
Well, have I got news for you. So this is an article out of Dermatologic Therapy, and it's by chief authors Avner Shemer and Aaron Galili. And they are actually out of Tel Aviv, Israel, Netanya, Israel, and Haifa, Israel, as well as the Toronto School of Medicine. And this article will discuss the ability to treat rosacea with a sort of spaced-dosed isotretinoin. Not like isotretinoin in space, but isotretinoin spaced out over time.
Yeah, so, I don't think they'd let you be an astronaut if you were on isotretinoin. Maybe astrotretinoin.
Astrotretinoin, yes, we should develop that. That would be very cool. It's isotretinoin for the astronauts. Because, you know, space acne, so hot right now. So, rosacea is, as we all know, a common inflammatory facial skin condition. It can cause papulopustular lesions, and it's treated often by topical and oral antibiotics. But some patients are severely resistant to these medications, or they can be recalcitrant to antibiotics. So, sometimes people will use daily low-dose isotretinoin. There haven't been any studies looking at once-weekly dosed isotretinoin for papulopustular rosacea, but these authors have found that to be potentially helpful in their practice. So they've done a retrospective comparative study, which means this is something that they found that worked in their practice, and so they had a group of patients that they treated this way because they found that worked for them. And after a period of time, they kind of went, huh, that's been working really well for this cohort of patients. Why don't we look back on them and maybe compare them to some other patients and see if there is a difference in treatment response or potentially if we could prove that this is a viable treatment option. Now, importantly, these treatments are all happening outside of the United States because this treatment protocol would be complicated, possibly impossible to use with the iPledge system as it exists in the United States. But I think that they've done a very good job showing a proof of concept that this can potentially work. So for severe rosacea in this retrospective and comparative study, they used 40 milligrams once weekly for isotretinoin for 24 patients. They also had mild to moderate rosacea that they used once weekly, 20 milligrams of isotretinoin for 28 patients. And they compared those patients with 100 milligrams per day of minocycline, which was 24 patients. Their treatment courses lasted from 4 to 7 months. They found that 40 milligrams once weekly of isotretinoin was highly effective for severe rosacea and achieved complete response, which is over 90% improvement in 62% of their patients. And they had a partial response, 50 to 90% improvement, in an additional 29%. So all of their patients with severe rosacea improved somewhat on once weekly 40 milligrams isotretinoin. When they looked at the 20 milligrams per week isotretinoin versus the 100 milligrams per day of minocycline, those had comparable efficacy for mild to moderate rosacea with a complete response rate of 10 to 8%, so 10% for the isotretinoin group, 8% for the minocycline once daily group, and a partial response rate of 28% for the isotretinoin group versus 33% for the minocycline group. So comparable efficacy between those two. So they demonstrated through this study that a once weekly dose of low-dose isotretinoin was effective to treat papulopustular rosacea, including patients with severe disease. Now, this is important because rosacea is common. Depending on what text you look at, it affects between 1% to 22% of the adult population. The reason I think that that variance is so wide is because it is differentially expressed in different patient populations, with people with Northern European ancestry sometimes being more prone to have these kinds of rosacea outbreaks, and patients in other groups potentially being less likely to develop this. It does also tend to favor patients in the mid-age, so 4th to 6th decades of life, and it's seen more amongst female patients with lighter colored skin. There are the four morphologic subtypes: erythematotelangiectatic, the fleshy blushy kind of rosacea, papulopustular, which is self-explanatory, phimatous rosacea, which can occur with thickening of the sebaceous areas of the face, either in the nose where it's called rhinophyma, it can happen on the chin where it's called mentophyma or nathophyma, and it can also happen in the glabella. And then, of course, there's ocular rosacea, which can cause severe inflammation and irritation of the eye, as well as the sensation of grit or sand in the eyes. Pathophysiology is not completely understood, but we believe that there's an aberrant innate immune response. There may be some neurovascular dysfunction, especially with erythematotelangiectatic rosacea, and infestation with Demodex folliculorum or Demodex brevis have also been implicated. Genetic susceptibility also seems to be pertinent, as many patients will have a family history of rosacea up to 20% of the time, and environmental factors like alcohol, heat, ultraviolet light, spicy foods, or smoking can aggravate rosacea. If it's not treated, it tends to persist. Of all the subtypes, the papulopustular rosacea responds best to pharmacological treatment, which could be topical or systemic antibiotics. Some patients are also treated with low daily doses of isotretinoin, even for patients with severe disease. However, if you could potentially treat patients with a once weekly dose, that could be quite beneficial, potentially improving compliance and decreasing complications. So they looked at this through this retrospective study to determine if the patients responded well, and if they did, which dose was optimal for those patients. For these patients, they also had a rating of the disease improvement by the treating dermatologist, as well as the patient satisfaction. Topical metronidazole gel twice daily was co-administered in some cases, so this wasn't monotherapy for all patients. And normal baseline blood counts and chemistries, liver enzymes, and lipid profiles were required to start isotretinoin treatment, which I think is reasonable. Anytime a drug has a lot of heat around it, a lot of noise, if you will, the attention of the trial lawyers, I think having some baseline value is sensible. I had a patient that I treated for onychomycosis with itraconazole, and this patient had previously undiagnosed thrombocytopenia, just idiopathic thrombocytopenia. One of the side effects of itraconazole is thrombocytopenia, so this was something that made his very concerned wife very, very worried for a very long time until we could find old labs to help us demonstrate that this was a pre-existing and normal value for this patient. So I think having a baseline is very reasonable to do.
We've talked about the possible utility or unutility of isotretinoin labs in previous episodes, and my feeling is that the research currently supports that in otherwise healthy young people, like under 30, that they're not useful. However, these patients are probably over 30. So I'm still on board with getting some labs, even me, the anti-isotretinoin labber. But I would probably just get ALT and triglycerides.
I think that that's reasonable. I think probably having some kind of lipid panel is just good to know what their baseline is. The compliance regimen was evaluated during their follow-up, and it was based on patient self-report adherence to treatment and prescription issuing data, which was retrieved from their medical electronic files. They measured the treatment response on a 5-point global improvement scale, with 0 meaning deteriorated from previous or unchanged, 1% being mild improvement, 2 being moderate improvement, which is like 25 to 50%. It basically goes by quarters. So 1 is 25% improvement or less. 2 is moderate improvement, so 25 to 50% of improvement. 3 is marked improvement, 50 to 90%. And 4 is complete response or almost complete cure, so over 90% improvement. And that was evaluated again by the treating physician. Now, the treating physician was unblinded. They knew what they were prescribing to the patient. Of the 77 patients with the papulopustular rosacea that they included in this retrospective cohort, they had mild rosacea in 14%, moderate in 50%, and severe in 30%. Mean age was about 52 years, and about almost 80% of these patients were female. Disease duration had been about 7 years in patients, so this was tried and true rosacea, representing fairly well the general patient population we treat for this condition. In this patient population, about half of them were unsuccessfully treated with topical antibiotics, and a family history of rosacea was reported in 30% of patients. Unprotected sun exposure was present in about 70%, past or current cigarettes in about 60%, and consumption of 2 or more alcoholic beverages per week was present in about 44%. When they looked at the factors associated with severe disease compared to mild or moderate disease, older age, family history of rosacea, excessive coffee consumption, which is bad news for me because I am a Java girl, all of these things were associated with more severe disease. The excessive coffee consumption makes me sad. The potential for the alcohol consumption to also be pertinent was also seen, with patients having severe disease being more likely to have 87% of those patients had alcohol consumption more than twice per week.
So I should cut down on my 5 Irish coffees a day if I want to stay rosacea free.
Yes, you should.
So well, this is pretty cool. 40 milligrams a week? That's like so small. Mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned that the odds of getting this working in the United States with iPledge is not great. However, I have a colleague who says he treats patients with 40 milligrams twice a week and has great results. And that's, you know, here in this country. A conversation with him is why I decided to look into this article. So I like the idea. I did have one patient with rosacea where I tried to get him on isotretinoin, but I started at a more traditional dosing, but low, like 20 milligrams a day or something, and he had some side effects and didn't want to do it anymore. But maybe I should have just started him on 40 milligrams twice a week or 20 milligrams twice a week, and we could have got him through. It's kind of cool.
I think so, too. You know, they had a good response, especially to the higher dose. And, you know, 40 milligrams once weekly had very favorable safety profile. So I think that this is a potential therapy to see if there's a way to properly do. Of course, the caveat being any patient who is reproductively capable needs to be properly monitored. And you need to ensure that pregnancy doesn't occur on drug, because even once weekly dosing could potentially still interfere with neural tube development. And of course, you also need to inform the patients, just like you do anybody on Accutane or isotretinoin, that they should not donate blood while on drug to make sure that it doesn't accidentally find its way into the body of a pregnant patient.
Yeah, so check it out. This is a cool option, I think. Michelle, do you remember the year 2014?
I do.
As a reminder, it was about 9 years ago. What were you doing in 2014?
I was teaching dermatology residents. Luke, what were you up to?
I was being taught. So I was an intern. I finished my intern year and became a new derm resident and moved to Lubbock, Texas, where you and I started a relationship for the ages. In 2014, the top song was Happy by Pharrell Williams.
'Cause I'm happy. I'm happy you were a resident with me. You've been an exemplary colleague.
I was also happy to watch Guardians of the Galaxy in theaters that year and play of the Magic the Gathering expansion Khans of Tarkir. I was less happy that there was an Ebola outbreak. But in 2014, in addition, this article was published. It's called Leukotriene Receptor Antagonists for Chronic Urticaria, a Systematic Review. It was published in a journal called Allergy, Asthma, and Clinical Immunology. And the authors include Nippon Lakshita Da Silva and Sanaka Rajapakse. Sorry for butchering your names, guys. Out of Sri Lanka. So, should we be using leukotriene receptor antagonists in chronic urticaria?
Good question.
I didn't think so. I don't remember like learning that they were a good idea. I kind of remember learning about 4x dosing of antihistamines and omalizumab and hand-wavy other stuff. And at Grand Rounds a few weeks ago here at the University of Utah, there was a patient who was coming in from an outside provider and had been treated with antihistamines and montelukast, and I said, well, montelukast isn't something we usually use for chronic urticaria. And a couple of my colleagues said, well, I do use that sometimes. So I thought, I better learn. So this is the article that's hopefully going to let me learn. It's a systematic review of 10 trials that looked at patients with chronic urticaria. And they were treated with leukotriene receptor antagonists, sometimes also with antihistamines, sometimes with placebo. And the upshot is that these leukotriene receptor antagonists do have added benefit for patients who have not responded to 4x dosing of antihistamines, and these leukotriene receptor antagonists seem to be quite safe, but don't use them as monotherapy because they don't seem very effective that way. So why does this work? Well, leukotrienes are pro-inflammatory molecules. Yes, leukotriene, one of my many nicknames. We know leukotrienes have a role in asthma and also pathophysiologically contribute to hives. And there are medications to block their effects, most commonly montelukast, which the brand name is Singulair. And there's also one called zafirlukast, but I don't think anyone really uses that one. So I'm just going to shortcut and say montelukast instead of leukotriene receptor antagonist, because it's pretty much the one that was used in almost all these trials. So I already told you the upshot. Go ahead and add them as an adjunct to 4x dosing antihistamine in your chronic urticaria patients. But the trials that led the authors to this conclusion were, trial 1 was 160 patients. It was antihistamine, versus antihistamine plus montelukast versus montelukast plus placebo. There was another study that was 30 patients, montelukast versus placebo, each with PRN antihistamines. There was a study with 50 patients, montelukast versus placebo. A study with 29 patients, montelukast versus placebo. A study with 86 patients, which had montelukast plus an antihistamine versus a placebo plus antihistamine. There was a study with 24 patients, which was leukotriene receptor antagonist. Oh, I did it. I'm sorry. Montelukast plus antihistamine versus placebo plus antihistamine. There was a study with 81 patients, antihistamine plus placebo versus antihistamine plus montelukast versus placebo alone. There was a study with 120 patients, which was cetirizine plus hydroxyzine versus famotidine plus hydroxyzine versus hydroxyzine plus montelukast versus placebo. Then there was a study with 27 patients, montelukast versus antihistamine, and there was a study of 20 patients, montelukast versus antihistamine. And again, the thrust is that don't use them as monotherapy, but they're helpful adjuncts. The authors say that different outcome measures in these studies and other heterogeneity prevented a true meta-analysis, but the overall thrust was what I've said three times. It's possible that montelukast, etc., has more or less of a role in more severe and or refractory chronic urticaria, but the data is unclear. You might also consider the cost. So my favorite non-sedating antihistamine these days is, well, what's yours, Michelle? I shouldn't bias you by telling you mine first.
I like Allegra, fexofenadine.
Fexofenadine. Why do you like that one?
Because my husband, who's an allergist, favors it because he feels like it works better for patients with urticaria. And in my experience, it does as well. And most people tolerate it well. It's relatively inexpensive. It's non-sedating in everyone. So cetirizine is supposed to be non-sedating, but I think about a quarter of the time it can get through the blood-brain barrier in certain patients and make them sleepy. I feel like Claritin or loratadine really doesn't work very well at all. Some people really like Zizol. I think that's a reasonable one, but also can still be sedating, even though it's not supposed to be.
Yeah, levocetirizine or Zizol was mine, because somebody once told me that it is in fact the least sedating, including of medicines like fexofenadine, but I haven't actually looked at the data myself. It's pretty cheap anyways. It's $20 for 95 milligram tabs. I think one reason I don't like fexofenadine is because the dosing is weird. Like, it's not pleasant fives and tens. It's like, I don't know, 140 milligrams or something. Mm-hmm. Hydroxyzine. I like hydroxyzine. It's pretty cheap too. It's $10 for 30, 25 milligram tabs. And if you have a child and they have to drink a solution of hydroxyzine, it's pretty similar in price, pretty cheap. Montelukast, also pretty cheap. $15 for 30, 10 milligram tabs. Just don't use zafirlukast. It's more expensive and requires BID dosing. According to this study, the side effects of medicines like montelukast seem to be non-existent. Great. However, but the FDA website disagrees.
Yes.
It mentions upper respiratory infection, fever, headaches, sore throat, cough, stomach pain, diarrhea, earache or ear infection, flu, runny nose, and sinus infection. In addition, apparently in 2020, so I guess 6 years after this was published, the FDA added a black box warning about, quote, serious neuropsychiatric events with these leukotriene receptor antagonists. They say the types of events reported were highly variable and included but were not limited to agitation, aggression, depression, sleep disturbances, suicidal thoughts, and behavior, including suicide.
Yep.
Were you going to provide more details about this terrifying issue?
I was going to say that, not myself personally, but somebody I know has had to deal with the potential psychoactive effects of that medication. So it is one that you want to be thoughtful about, patients that you prescribe it to. If they have, you know, the greatest predictor for a suicide attempt is a prior attempt, right? And so if you have a patient that carries that risk factor, it doesn't mean that they can't have that medication, but you need to have that discussion with them and make sure that they are capable of enacting a safety plan, that they can, you know, get somewhere safe, call someone that they feel comfortable with, get emergency care if they do confront some of those difficult psychiatric symptoms. But yeah, that is something that may have created a little angst in the Tarbox household once. So something I will never forget.
Seems like a side effect that has emerged over the 6 years since this thing was published. Mm-hmm. At least these medicines do seem to be safe in pregnancy, but the powers that be advise avoiding it if you can and don't start it during pregnancy. But if the patient's got, you know, bad asthma and it's controlling them, they stay on it. Some montelukast does get into breast milk. Seems like it's probably not the big issue, though. For patients who continue to be refractory, this review mentions that some other options include cyclosporin, dapsone, H2 antihistamines, systemic steroids for flares, and omalizumab.
Importantly, the leukotriene modifying agents are on the STEP guidelines. They're step 2 on the US guidelines, but they're step 3 on the European guidelines. So there's different access points depending where in the world you live.
So thanks, my colleagues. I was wrong, and it turns out that sometimes we should use these. I mean, I still don't really love it, though. The 4x dosing of antihistamines is going to be what makes people better or not. I honestly am not sure that adding montelukast and or famotidine or something is going to move the needle on very many patients who weren't already getting better. And I don't know how many of those patients you end up saving from omalizumab or one of these other drugs as well. Plus, I don't like this neuropsychiatric stuff. That's kind of scary. But if the patient, you know, can't get omalizumab and mibidine isn't a candidate for other stuff, it at least seems like a reasonable thing to add.
For those people who are potentially studying for their boards, there's a new dog on the block with chronic spontaneous urticaria that I think is about to be released. That's a Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So when you were learning about those immunodeficiencies in medical school, you might not have realized that some of those pathophysiologic pathways that create those presentations may be therapeutic targets. But this is something that is being looked into as well for chronic spontaneous urticaria. Other things, of course, with patients who have CSU, you want to eliminate anything that could be triggering it. So of course, avoiding triggers like NSAIDs, reviewing any kind of physical factors like a physical urticaria, cold or pressure, patients exposed to different things that may trigger that, you would want to avoid those exposures. Managing chronic spontaneous urticaria is a challenge sometimes. Those patients are kind of miserable. It can sincerely affect their quality of life and make it hard for them to do their activities of daily living. I've had some patients that changed jobs because their urticaria would act up when they were under stress and they couldn't tolerate it anymore. So I'm grateful that we have therapeutic options. I think anytime we can think about thoughtful management and management strategies that might help the patients, I think that those are also very good things.
Do you remember the name of this new medicine you mentioned?
I knew you were going to ask me that. Hold on. It's got a kind of funny name, as all of our new medications do.
I think ligelizumab on the podcast before.
Hold on. I'm going to get the right name because I don't want to say it wrong. Hold on. Let's see. What is this called? Remibrutinib is what it looks like, is probably what's happening here.
Fun.
So it does have a Bruton tyrosine kinase, like, that, you know, brute is in there, so you can figure it out. I'm pretty sure most of the medicines in this class are going to have that brute in the middle. Yeah, fenbrutinib is another one. So if you hear brute in the middle of an inib, you're dealing with a Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitor.
Maybe this is too tangential, but what's a Bruton tyrosine kinase?
Oh, good Lord. Okay, so...
You brought this upon yourself.
I 100% did. So way back in medical school, you guys may remember learning about Bruton tyrosine kinase and the fact that patients that have a deficiency in this are going to develop a compromised immune system. So it is a critical mediator of B cell receptor signaling and can help sort of develop immune responses. It is a non-receptor kinase, and it's very important in immune function. So it's part of adaptive immunity.
It's a non-receptor kinase?
Yeah, non-receptor kinase. So there are receptor kinases where they will be transmembrane receptors, and they pick up something in the outside environment of the cell, and then they signal through their tyrosine kinase on the inside for a pathway to occur. There are non-receptor tyrosine kinases that have something else that signals it to pass its signal. A good example of this kind of signaling might be kind of what we see with patched and smoothened, although I'm not 100% sure that they're tyrosine kinases, but it's sort of similar relationship where you have the signaling happening from a compound molecule, basically.
I remember Bruton's hypogammaglobulinemia. Is that what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. That is actually why it is identified and has been studied so much. It's pretty kind of pretty cool as a potential target for therapy for immune mediated disease, and I think that it could be a very interesting therapeutic option.
So is Bruton a Nazi bastard? Do we have start calling this something else?
Oh, that's a good question. Dude, I haven't checked. He doesn't sound terribly German, but we could certainly check. And no shade to the Germans. They've been doing great lately. They're killing it.
All right. Why don't you talk about our next article and I'll go on an info quest about Bruton and whether or not we should dislike it.
Yes, help me figure out. Let's see if there's any skeletons in the closet of Bruton. While Luke goes on that info quest, I shall inform you about real-world safety and clinical response of Janus kinase inhibitor upadacitinib in the treatment of hidradenitis suppurativa. This is a retrospective cohort study in the JAD, and this is from 2022. The key authors here are Emily Kozra, and we also have chief authors John W. Frew, who has done some advisory work for several pharmaceutical companies, including, I believe, the one that produces upadacitinib, but he's got such a broad spread across the different pharmaceutical companies. Some people who have that sort of broad involvement seem to almost cancel themselves out a little bit because they've learned about all of the different things. So hopefully there's not bias in this, but this is a letter to the editor where they talk about hidradenitis suppurativa. And of course it is a chronic relapsing autoinflammatory disease that needs novel therapeutic options. Janus kinase inhibition has been identified as a strategy for managing HS, with ongoing clinical trials looking at safety and efficacy. Upadacitinib is Janus kinase 1 selective inhibitor. It is used to treat inflammatory arthropathies, inflammatory bowel disease that share similarities with HS. HS trials often will exclude patients that have significant disease, greater than 20 draining tunnels. So real-world evidence is kind of necessary to treat these knowledge gaps and address these. So they looked at a retrospective cohort study of their patients with moderate to severe HS that had been treated with upadacitinib monotherapy from October 2021 to May 2022. They looked at demographics, disease-specific information, including lesion counts, as well as quality of life and pain scores. And I can't emphasize enough how important quality of life and pain scores are for patients with HS. This is a very, very morbid disease. I think it's one of the most important conditions dermatologists treat because of the impact it has on the quality of life of the patients that suffer from it. And so finding therapeutics that actually work for these patients, I think, is a good priority for our specialty. They identified 20 patients and they gathered their demographic and disease details. They also screened all patients for HIV, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, tuberculosis. They checked fasting lipids and creatinine kinase. And they also did baseline CBC, CMP, and of course their lipid panel.
This is like baseline JAK inhibitor stuff.
Yeah.
So it's probably bellworthy that those are the things you should consider checking.
That is true. I always forget to ring the bell for myself. So these are all the laboratory tests you would want to check to start any Janus kinase inhibitor. All patients started on the lower dose of upadacitinib at 15 milligrams per day until week 4. And then if they had a lack of response with the high scores, the hidradenitis suppurativa clinical response scale, at week 4, they increased those patients to upadacitinib 30 milligrams per day. And then they reviewed their progress at weeks 12 and 24. Included patients did not have any surgical intervention, intralesional steroid injection, or concomitant antibiotics for the first 24 weeks of therapy. They looked at clinical photographs, which they've presented also in this publication, and they found that 15 of the 20 patients achieved a high score of 50, or high score 50 at week 4, so that's like 50% improvement. That increased to 100% of patients achieving that high score 50 at week 12, and then they maintained that until week 24. So just like PASI scores, these get progressively harder to acquire. So I'm not sure if I'm saying this right, but I just call it high score because it's easier to say than high score. High score 75 was obtained in 30% of patients at week 4, and that increased to 95% at week 12 and was maintained until week 24. And then their high score 90 rates were recorded in 20% of patients at week 4, that increased to 30% at week 12, maintained until week 24. So they were able to show improvement that continued to basically whatever the plateau would be for that patient and then was sustained. So there was no loss of response in this 24-week follow-up, which is always nice to see. Of course, we always want to look at longer and longer follow-up so we can ensure that patients will maintain response to their medication. They looked at the DLQI, the Dermatology Life Quality Index score, as well as pain rating scores, and they saw that these things both improved, and by improvement, both of these will decrease. The DLQI, the higher that number is, the greater the impact of the condition on the patient's quality of life. And of course, the higher a pain rating score is, the more pain the patient is experiencing. 20% of the patients experienced flares, which would be any new lesions during treatment. All of those reported new abscesses, one or two, and in contrast to previous flares with smaller nodules, so there may be a different immunologic basis for these abscesses compared with nodules or tunnels. One piece of information I couldn't really find in this publication was whether or not those abscesses were cultured, because it does make you wonder if JAK inhibition might increase risk for infection in these patients. So that's something that I think should be probably looked at. One of the patients had a varicella zoster reactivation, which is something that you need to watch for patients who have an immunosuppression. That was confirmed by lesional PCR, and they were treated with a typical valacyclovir course with no interruption of their upadacitinib therapy. They also had two individuals that had mild transient transaminitis during therapy, which spontaneously resolved. Importantly, 16 out of 20 patients demonstrated elevated creatinine kinase at weeks 4 and 12, but they didn't have any musculoskeletal symptoms or myoglobulinemia. And 12 of the 20 received COVID vaccinations during treatment with no significant disease flare. 4 of the 20 also contracted COVID with mild symptoms that did not interrupt their therapy. And 3 of the individuals had deroofing procedures undertaken after week 24 with no adverse outcomes noted postoperatively. So this is a single center experience with HS on monotherapy with upadacitinib. They had good levels of clinical response and comparable rates of varicella zoster virus reactivation, transaminitis, and CK elevation as seen in the clinical trials for other inflammatory dermatoses treated with Janus kinase inhibitors. Escalation to 30 milligrams was associated with improved outcomes in early stage 3 disease, and they didn't have any serious adverse events that necessitated cessation of treatment, even in the setting of COVID infection or adjuvant surgical interventions. So, of course, they advocate for larger placebo-controlled trials, but it's a promising first look into treating patients with these novel medications who have bad HS.
Really promising. I feel like JAK inhibitors might be the next thing for HS. What do you think?
I think that's definitely a promising arena. Of course, we have to be thoughtful around the space of the complications that can arise from those medications. Our patients with HS may, on the balance, tend to be a little bit more pro-inflammatory. I'm encouraged that they didn't have any vasculoocclusive or thrombotic events in this study. I know that the most significant number of those was reported in patients with RA, not in the conditions that we tend to treat, and typically with tofacitinib. Did you ever watch Avatar: The Last Airbender, Luke?
Never did, but I'm told it's good.
There's a character in that named Toph, and Toph is an earthbender, and she's like really strong. And I always think of that when I think of tofacitinib, because tofacitinib is strong. Like, it inhibits all of the Janus kinase like enzyme isoforms, basically, and it does so relatively broadly. So it's pretty darned immunosuppressive. Of course, patients with RA tend to be more pro-inflammatory than most dermatology patients, but there are some subsets of patients with HS that really have high systemic inflammation, and I think you'd have to be a little bit careful about VTE with those patients, but I'm encouraged that even their severe patients didn't show a signal in this study.
You might also be putting them on OCPs, which are pro-coagulant, I guess, but our patient populations with HS are usually pretty young, and HS can certainly have comorbidities, but they don't usually have like the histories that the patients in those trials had.
True.
So, plus, it's a small molecule, so I'm wondering if these are going to be easier to make as generics sometime. How long has tofacitinib been around? It feels like it's got to be pushing 10 years. Are we going to have?
It feels like it's getting close to that. That's a good question.
Can we start getting generic JAK inhibitors so they don't cost $3,000 to $5,000 a month, and we can honestly treat all of the reasonable candidates with them? I'm excited about JAK inhibitors for hidradenitis suppurativa. And listeners, think about citing this paper if you're going to ask for them for your patients from their insurance, because I think there's pretty reasonable data here. And there's probably going to be more stuff coming out as the next months and years roll by here. Remember, new CDC guidelines, or latest CDC guidelines, are to get your patients the shingles vaccine before you immunosuppress them, especially with one of these drugs, I would say, since shingles does seem to be a significant side effect that a lot of people get. They should get the first dose of the shingles vaccine before they start the medicine, but they can get the subsequent dose after they've already started it.
And you were right, Luke. It was first approved in 2012.
Michelle, we should start a pharmaceutical company and produce generic tofacitinib. Maybe we can have it sponsored by Avatar.
They could call it Tof. The last Earthbender.
Well, Michelle, in addition to that, I have some really good news for you.
I'm excited.
Dr. Bruton was the opposite of a Nazi.
Yay! Hashtag not thing, a Nazi.
For one thing, he was American. Dr. Ogden Bruton was a pediatrician and chief of pediatrics at Walter Reed Army Hospital.
Oh.
And in addition to his work on immunology and discovering this disease that now has his name, he was awarded, let's see, something or other. He got a significant award. Here it is. The Department of Defense Distinguished Civilian Service Award, which is the highest Department of Defense award given to civilians, requiring the approval of the Secretary of Defense. And now there is an award called the Ogden C. Bruton Award, which is given annually for the best paper submitted by a military pediatrician for either basic or applied research on the development, evaluation, or application of technology in pediatrics.
I like it. That's really cool.
Well, that is all the time we have for today, friends. So thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to our institutions for supporting the podcast. Thanks to the University of Utah, and thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. Mm-hmm. Thanks also to all the members of Team Dermosphere. You heard from most of them last time, but thanks again to Morgan Dykman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Angie Wong, and Lara Dela Cruz, who do a lot to keep this moving along behind the scenes. Among other things, they keep our social media clipping along. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and the app formerly known as Twitter. You can also find us on our on our website, DermosphereRadio.com. It has links to all of the original articles we discussed. It also has our entire archive. It's a good way to reach out to us as well, so swing on by and say hello. And we'll see you guys in 2 weeks.
Woo-hoo!